Hey everybody, it's Paul Yeager. Welcome inside to another installment of the MTOM Show podcast, which is a production of the Market to Market TV show here at Iowa PBS. There we go. Today we're going to go on a book tour. We're going to talk with the author of this one, Neil Hamilton. The Land Remains. Neil is a former college professor. He's in emeritus status now. We're going to ask him what that means. But we're going to get in some of the topics into his book, The Land. We're going to talk about water. As he said, we might step on the ice and crack a little bit here. So give a listen to what Neil Hamilton has to say, what prompted him to write this book. And I always want to know what prompts you to listen or watch this podcast. So if you have any feedback for me, send it to me at paul.yeager@iowapbs.org. Love to hear from you. If you have any feedback for me, send it there. Otherwise, let's get to class with Neil Hamilton. You're a professor, so you always have the background of books. Did you ever think that you'd be putting one of your books on the shelf and somebody would have it back there behind you when they talked?
Well, I certainly always dreamed of it, and this is a book that I've started on a number of occasions, and so it's very satisfying to actually have it published, and really exciting to be able to go into a bookstore and actually see it on the shelf. So,
what was that like the first time when you saw that?
Well, I did. It's very fulfilling. You know, it makes it very real, right? And that because it's a project that, like I said, had been underway for a while, and actually working on it wrote on it for a year, and then we edited it and published it, and so it'd been about 2 years since it started, and then it's a little bit like waiting for the ketchup, right? Waiting to see it published, and when's it going to be back from the printers, and oh my gosh, and now it's here, and so it's been out for a couple months, and I'm excited that it's getting some good responses to people, and people coming up and telling me they've read it or getting emails from people, so it's exciting.
In retirement, you're supposed to slow down, not speed up. How'd that happen?
Well, I'm not sure about, the retirement, whether it's a slow down, speed up, or it's a go do certain other things that maybe you've been putting off, right? It changes the nature of what you get to do. And it certainly seems like I'm in here at my office at Drake as much as when they were actually sending me a paycheck. But I'm enjoying what I'm doing, and certainly enjoy writing. And there are certain things and you don't have to worry about, preparing for class and kind of that regular routine of classroom preparation, but longer, periods of time to be able to think and to write. And that's how this book finally came about.
You're in emeritus status now at Drake University?
Yes, that means you're old and retired, and they let you call yourself a professor, but they don't have to worry about paying you, I think.
But it is an honorific.
Yes.
Yeah, but you also said they do give you space to come and work.
Well, I have an office. Still have an office and access to my email and computer and printer. And so, no, I'm very happy to be an emeritus professor. And I spent a long time here. I was on the faculty for 36 years here and a couple years at the University of Arkansas before that. So I spent most of my lifetime being a professor.
Did you ever think that you were going to be a farmer?
No, not a farmer in the kind of the traditional sense of the way my mom and dad spent their lives farming. I think I probably mentioned this in the book. It wasn't their dream for either my brother or I to farm. And that was maybe a product of the 50s and 60s. It wasn't the easiest time, particularly on a relatively small farm. And so I think like many farm families and parents, they had visions of their children going on to college and going on doing other things. But of course, ironically, I am a farmer along with my wife, a different type of farmer. We have a small market garden, but about an acre of things. I was out in the garden this morning putting in some more fennel, trying to get it planted. One of the issues with having a greenhouse is you start all these things, and then once you have all these plants started, oh my gosh, we need another set of tomato gates put up, and it seems like it never ends. But so I enjoy farming very much, raising food for people.
And that's a theme in the book about how we raise. You raise several different points, but again, I want to just make sure I fill in a little bit of your background. Adams County is where you grew up. Family involved in agriculture, but college and but it was forestry that you first had a fancy for.
Sure. Yeah, Adams County, most sparsely populated county in the state, you know, and family's been there since the 1870s and a long time, you know, farmers and landowners. But I graduated from high school in 72, and it was just, the beginning, if you think about it, the modern environmental movement. We'd had Earth Day, and as I relate in the book, I got selected, so to speak, to go to the Environmental Education Center in Eagle River, Wisconsin, and it turns out it was basically a recruiting program by Iowa State and Michigan and Wisconsin for their forestry schools. But so I went to forestry school at Iowa State and certainly don't have any regrets. And I think very much going to forestry school certainly changed the trajectory of my career and gave me a much different perspective about the land. And, you know, it's interesting, there are any number of people that have worked in agricultural policy and conservation, in effect, that were foresters and had studied forestry. And so we each got our own tree at Iowa State, right? But it's the oldest forestry school west of the Mississippi. It has a long history of forestry.
And so the conservation movement in you was kind of planted, I guess, if you want to use that metaphor.
It really grew during that period, and I fell into bad company. I was a research assistant for the head of the program, Henry Webster, and was in the honors program, which was relatively new at that time, and it essentially let you create your own major. And so, I took ag econ classes from Dr. Harrell and Ross Talbot, and took sociology classes and urban planning classes. And I was essentially building what today would maybe be an environmental science degree, but we didn't have such a thing back then. And I'd early on, kind of gotten the political bug. Our family was very involved in the Democratic Party and Iowa caucuses, and I worked in Tom Harkin's campaign, his unsuccessful campaign in 72, and then his successful campaign in 74. And there's a picture in the book of the two of us standing on the steps of the Capitol in the summer of 1975, and I have a tie wide enough you could keep warm with it, and long hair, and he looks very young, right? Who would have known he went on to a 30-plus year career and a couple terms as the chair of the Senate Ag Committee? But but going on to law school and thinking about being an environmental law professor, but by the time I was done at Iowa State, I'd really come back to agriculture. And Dr. Harrell, Neil Harrell, had a lot to do with that. And so I went to the University of Iowa Law School, which ironically had an agricultural law program during the 1950s and 60s, had a USDA economist on staff, and a number of people who went through the University of Iowa and Iowa State in PhDs in economics also had been involved with the law school. But they'd killed that program by the time I got there in the mid-70s. But I continued to write in that area, and in fact wrote the piece I wrote as I was leaving law school was called "The Importance of Agricultural Law in the Law School Curriculum," and I really didn't realize it, but I was kind of writing the blueprint for what would be the next 40 years of my life as I became a professor trying to do that, to focus law schools around agricultural law.
You were tasked with kind of setting it up at Arkansas. And Drake is, for those that might not be from Iowa, I mean, it is a small private college in the middle of a metropolitan area. You don't think of it as, it's not a land grant institution. Did being at Drake with this specific focus allow Drake to be insulated from outside forces that may exist at, say, other land grant institutions?
Well, a couple things there. One, Drake would call itself a university, not a college.
Oh, sorry. Right. Yes, you are correct.
Yeah, that's fine. But I think you know, there's a couple pieces of that story. In some ways, because the University of Iowa and Wisely had walked away from agricultural law, I think Drake saw an opportunity to kind of steal a march, because a lot of students were coming from farm families and rural communities, and Drake was playing a role educating the legal community in the state. And so this was something that we could do, that we didn't necessarily have to worry that the University of Iowa was going to come back to. And also from Drake's standpoint, I was kind of a one-stop shop, and we didn't have an agronomy department, right? I mean, we weren't an agricultural college, but for one position and one program, we were able to have a seat at the table of many of the agriculture and important social developments in Iowa, because we were looking at the legal issues and, whether it was, land or water or consolidation or whatever the issue might have been, it oftentimes comes back to the role that law plays. And so Drake, was kind of able to, I think, hit above its weight in terms of its involvement in the policy questions. But then, as you also touch on, not being a land-grant university and not really being beholden to anybody, it gave us a real autonomy. I didn't have to ask anybody's permission to put on a conference about, soil conservation or small farms or environmental issues. No one had a receipt, is how I like to think about it.
Well, you talk about your family's involvement in democratic politics. It just seems that so many things in university level have become political, whether it's one or another. There's a lot of people that want to see institutions that are funded by the state, whatever state it is, not just Iowa, mm-hmm. want to see less taxpayer money, let yourself be self-sufficient. Did you feel in your time at Drake University, you talk about the independence of things. Did you feel that allowed you to have a different credibility with your students that were coming in and then with the work that you were doing?
Sure. Well, I'd certainly agree with you that, things have become increasingly politicized, and not necessarily politicized in a classic partisan sense of with a D or an R, other than that, you might attribute a more active role of government might align more with the traditional democratic approach as opposed to more of a Republican or a traditional Republican approach. It would be more free market. In terms of my relationship with my students, you'd have to ask them, but I certainly tried to bowl it down the middle in that it wasn't so much trying to put a particular spin on an issue. It might have been more issues that we were willing to address, right, and approaches that you'd come to them. I talk, in the book a fair amount about Aldo Leopold and, Leopold's, history and, of course, an Iowan, but, important across the nation, but with the land ethic and thinking about the role of personal responsibility and moral issues as relate to the land. And it was something that in forestry, is very much a part of kind of the thinking, a longer term horizon, multiple uses, role of the public. But yet, I don't know that a lot of people in the agronomy departments or, soil science or ag business were necessarily studying Leopold. And so, when students would take my environmental regulation of agriculture class, we'd always ask, I'd have them read the land ethic and think about, what are ethical obligations to the land? And that's perhaps more natural in law school because law has to be based on something, right? I mean, there's some value that we're trying to achieve that is some type of shared societal objective. The reason we require advance notice of termination of farm tenancies, right, is the idea that we're providing a social protection to tenants, and it grows out of the late 30s in terms of short-term notice. And then you had this kind of migration from farm to farm, the type of thing my mom's family certainly was caught up in at the end of the Depression. And so if we think about the law as trying to, deliver some type of, right, social objective that we want within society, well, what are the bases for those? And morality is one of those. And that's a subject in, you know, much of the book. It kind of deals with that question about our relationship to the land or the water and kind of the role that individuals play in that connection.
Individuals. That brings up a point. You mentioned Leopold. There's John Lacey. There's Ding Darling. There's a lot of names that you bring in here. Did you leave anybody out?
Well, I may have left some people out. Those are certainly historic figures. You mentioned John Lacey. A lot of people would have, he's kind of lost in the sands of time, but a congressman from Oskaloosa, Iowa, and at the turn of the last century was one of the most powerful congresspeople involved in conservation. He wrote the Antiquities Act that we still use today to designate presidential, you know, to national monuments. He wrote the Lacey Act, the first the game conservation laws, the laws that protect game birds. And so, and we have modern day conservationists. Tom Harkin, to some extent, fits that category, you know, authoring the Conservation Security Act or Stewardship Act, right? It changed names, but that's a significant role. But part of the point I think I was trying to make there is that we have this long legacy, and it's not clear today that we are maybe living up to the expectation that those folks would have had as to how we both treat the land and water, but also how we have this kind of shared private and public relationship with it.
Iowa is one of those states that others look to for certain subject matters. You mentioned the Iowa caucus that I was looked at for a long time as, well, who'd they winnow out? And then you flip it back to agriculture. Well, how are they growing corn and soybeans? I think you call them one and two. You had a term for it late in the book, and I'm drawing a blank on what it was, but kind of the A and B. Everybody looks at us for how we do that. Water's not one of those issues where maybe they look at us, but we might not be leading on. I know I have discussions with people about WOTUS or, you know, how they don't, you know, how could you say that puddle on my farm is a pollutant? How could you say, that's a very passionate response. At what point does Iowa need to take some leadership in water?
Oh, well, I think it, and I appreciate you bringing that up, and we can step out onto ice and let it crack if we want to, particularly as you mentioned WOTUS. But, you know, ironically, you know, Iowa in our statutes talk about how we want to be seen as a national leader on water quality and that we do this fine job of taking care of our land and water. But yet it's not clear that we are. We still lose much more soil than we should. The level of adoption of conservation practices is less than it could be. I'm serving now as a soil and water conservation commissioner elected in Dallas County, and so see firsthand, to some extent, almost the dysfunctionality of our soil and water conservation district system, because they don't have any staff, they don't have any direct funding, and so we could do a better job. And it's also, you know, unfortunately tied in to kind of a legal discussion. You know, agriculture has convinced itself, or maybe more importantly, convinced political leaders that volunteerism is somehow going to get us there, right? And so we even have been codified in the Iowa law that there's no role for regulations to play in water quality. Well, that's, you know, I think that's a silly and unfortunate approach. There's no other component of our economy that we have, right, taken off the board of somehow being subject to regulations. It's magical thinking to think that we're somehow going to protect the soil and water on a voluntary-only approach. And I think the history of the lack of our progress when it comes to the nutrient reduction strategy or whatever you want to look at is a good example. Society uses regulations to establish expected minimum standards of conduct on the part of people. And they're in everything we do, right? Whether it's a seatbelt that you had on, or, right, the handicap accessibility, or the speed limit that you drove on, right? And that's a way we communicate this kind of shared values between us. And we certainly have a lot of shared values, I would hope, when it comes to our land and water. I mean, the waters are actually public waters, right? The waters in the state are actually the waters of Iowa, as declared in public law. And you mentioned WOTUS, and I'll just touch on it enough to upset your audience. But, you know, WOTUS is a hoax, right? Agriculture has built this huge campaign around the idea that the EPA is going to come out and somehow regulate your land and tell you what you're going to do. Most people in agriculture have never seen anybody from the EPA and wouldn't know them if they bit them, right? The EPA actually works through the state, right? The state departments of natural resources. And the part that I find, it's almost humorous in that they talk, oh my gosh, you know, if we draw the line here, right, in terms of this jurisdictional reach between the federal and the state, because that's all WOTUS is. It's a question of where we draw the line. Well, then it's going to require all these things. You're going to have a permit to walk your calves across the pasture. Well, we already have a significant amount of land in the state that's subject to federal jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act, right? We have navigable rivers. There's no question that the Des Moines navigable, the Raccoon, right? All of those things happening on the land that's already subject to federal jurisdiction? Well, of course not. There's nobody requiring you to get a permit to walk your cows across a pasture, right? And so this idea that, you know, where we end up finally drawing that line is going to result in this somehow, you know, huge rewrite of the reach of federal authority. It just, you know, it's been a wonderfully successful political campaign. Don't get me wrong on that, but there's very little truth to most of it. And the irony is, in fact, to me, and ironies are everywhere you look, but the original, right, kind of Obama WOTUS proposal had a provision that exempted tile outlets from being considered point sources, which the law currently doesn't answer that. And that was one of the underlying questions in the Des Moines Water Works lawsuit. And so preventing that regulation from coming into effect basically left the question of whether tile drain outlets are actually point sources or not still kind of an open question. But I'll get off that box.
Well, no, and that's an interesting box. You open up a couple there. Let's stick with the Des Moines Water Works suit. That is sure. If you want to talk about a political framing, there are some who think that it was framed a rural versus urban in every sense of, you know, Des Moines was upset at what rural Iowa was doing to them and their water. Yeah. Bill Stowe was a champion for water, and you want to talk about a guy with a couple of degrees? He'd thought a few things through, felt very passionate about it. We were about that close from being into a trial. What do you think would have happened had that went to trial?
Sure. Well, you know, clearly, you know, Bill Stowe was frustrated with the lack of anybody else upstream being willing to take any responsibility, right? It was downstream. It was a waterworks problem. You guys clean it up, right? I think if the drainage districts or counties upstream would have done almost anything to say, you know, we do have some responsibility, the lawsuit probably wouldn't have happened. But the lawsuit did happen, and I think there's a fair amount of confusion as to how the lawsuit ended, right? I mean, what happened was federal Judge Bennett, who now is on the faculty here at Drake, right, because the underlying questions dealt with the authority of the drainage districts to do something, because the claim was that they were point sources. They were administering these ditches and pipes, and so if they were a point source, they were going to have to do something. He certified a series of questions to the Iowa Supreme Court for them to answer under Iowa law, do the drainage districts have any authority to do any of these things? Okay. Judge Bennett retired, case was handed to another federal court, and when the Iowa Supreme Court came back and said, you know what, the way we read the Iowa drainage law, the drainage districts couldn't undertake a clean water project even if they wanted to, Well, then the federal court judge said, well, I'm not going to go ahead and consider whether or not they're a point source. There isn't anything that I could make them do. The case could have gone out differently. And let me just, you know, throw this out. The drainage districts, when they were sued, could have said, you know what? We agree. We are a point source. Right. And then they say, what do you want us to do? And the state would have said, well, gosh, you know, we don't really have a permit standard for drainage districts. Instead, we could have a generalized permit. You tell us what you want to do. So, okay, well, this is what we want to do. You know, we're going to put in some, you know, constructed wetlands. We're going to take 10 years to come up with a study. And the state could have said, fine, that's your permit. Bingo, bango. And that would have, right? That would have resolved the litigation. But the one difference would have been that the drainage districts would have accepted that they have some role to play in clean water. If you ask the question, what lesson did anybody learn, right? What did the upstream counties learn from the Des Moines Water Works lawsuit? It appears that the lesson they took was, we better start putting in more tile, right? They certainly haven't undertaken a campaign to say, you know what, we ought to get ahead of this water quality issue. Drainage districts in Iowa do have the authority to undertake water quality initiatives. There's a provision under the law that allows the Board of Supervisors to give them the same authority that Swan Water Conservation Districts have. And they could be leading, just like in Minnesota, the drainage districts are playing a key role in dealing with water quality issues. In Iowa, instead, you know, people were willing to say, oh my gosh, you know, Des Moines, they picked a fight with rural Iowa and we're still holding a grudge. And so we aren't going to do anything. And so we're going to apparently continue to pollute the water out of spite. But it doesn't get us very much farther down the road, I don't think.
I don't know that last comment. That one's, I'm not sure if they're polluting out of spite, because the farmers that tell me from that area, they say, why would I waste anything? And in this year, that's become very expensive for them. Right. The fertilizer, the nitrogen, the chemical, whatever, it's high. And you hear about the, I think I said this last week with talking about water with the producer in California, teaspooning it on. The nitrogen might get applied on at different times, trying not to waste because they want it in that plant. So in a way, I that is part of that discussion, but I'm guessing by your facial expression, you've heard that one before.
Well, I guess 2 points. You've heard all along that, you know, nitrogen is very expensive. I never put on any more than I possibly need, right? Well, if that's true, then why is it that we have so much of it that comes off, right?
Well, there's something wrong with the drainage system, which gets back to one of the questions.
You know, you look at your shampoo bottle next time, and it'll probably say apply, rinse, and apply again, right? And so, you know, I think it's fair to say that putting on a little bit more nitrogen to ensure that it's going to be there if you need it is not an uncommon practice. One of the silver linings, though, you know, you have to squint to see it perhaps, of higher fertilizer costs is, well, maybe people will be a little bit more efficient in terms of using it. You may remember I wrote an op-ed a year or so ago about the magic bullet to deal with water quality has been there all along. The maximum return to nitrogen, right? The MTRN rate. You know, here's this Purdue and Iowa State-based report. Here's the amount of nitrogen, right, that you should apply. And if you go and read the nutrient reduction strategy, right, the Golden Report in Iowa, every one of the scenarios that it's based on, and of course, nobody talks about the scenarios anymore, but the scenarios, right, were kind of what was used to sanctify the report. This was going to be how we were going to get to the reduction. The first recommendation, every one of those scenarios is apply nitrogen at the MTRN rate. And we currently apply nitrogen 20 to 30 pounds higher than the MTRN rate. And so when I wrote that op-ed, of course, the immediate response was from people, well, you know, that MTRN, it's not so scientific. You know, it's maybe a little bit outdated. There are good reasons why you might want to put on more nitrogen. Okay, well, there you go.
Well, and that's back to, yeah, some of the early points in your book. I had a, does the current pricing of everything, whether it's the inputs or cost are higher, the $17 soybeans and the high $7 corn, does that help change the discussion? Does it give fuel to making changes? Or does it mean I am not doing a thing because it's too good for me right now?
Well, you know, I think I talk about that. It says, when is the right time to ask, right? I mean, when prices are low and people aren't making a profit, then it's hard to say, boy, but you really ought to be investing some money in conservation water quality. Oh, I can't afford it. You know, how can you even ask me to do that now? Okay, well, how about now when beans are 17 and corn 7? How about now? Well, I'm not sure I can afford it now. Margins are pretty thin. You know, we can never afford it. At least, you know, I don't want to speak in, you know, absolutes, because clearly some people can. If it's important to you, or if society makes it important to you, or it becomes an important activity as a condition for the other things that you're more than happy to accept, such as crop insurance and farm program payments and a lot of other public benefits that are provided without very many questions asked, people would be able to afford conservation. The point is, now we don't really expect or ask anybody to do it, other than, you know, well, it's voluntary. We need, boy, people need more time, need more education. When's the right time?
Well, there's always a carrot and stick debate for those types of things, right?
Well, pretty much gave up the stick. You tell me what the stick is.
Yeah.
How many people have you talked to that have had their ticket pulled for violating conservation compliance?
You mentioned that in the book. You don't see that type of thing happens. So when you see a current scenario that we're in right now, and I'm talking the high prices for grain, and there doesn't seem to be anything that really wants to change a farmer's way of thinking. Does that give you more pessimism or optimism about the future?
Well, as you've just portrayed it, it's hard to look at that and not at least see some pessimism. Right. And the optimism, maybe you have to, you know, scramble for a little bit more. I guess my optimism would come in the sense that, you know, we didn't get here overnight. We're not going to get out of it overnight either. But these are decisions that we could make, that we could put more conditions on access to crop insurance. Right. I mean, if you want to identify something that maybe we ought to think about, is that we're farming 400,000 acres in Iowa in the two-year floodplain. This is the two-year floodplain, right? And it's being, right, crop insurance available. In fact, those premiums are probably largely being being funded by people farming the uplands, right, who are helping subsidize people farming in the bottomlands and being paid, right, when it floods. So we could rethink that a little bit, I believe. Why couldn't we condition the availability of some of these payments on, well, what is your nutrient management plan? Are you using cover crops, right? Instead, every time we come up with a new program, it's, well, you want cover crops? Well, how much will you pay me to put them in? Okay, well, and so, you know, it's all kind of an add-on. You know, one of the points I tried to make in the book is that, you know, land is imbued with a public dimension, right? Even though it may be private land. And as I say, if you don't believe that, try not paying your property taxes for a while, right? And see what happens.
Right.
See what happens, right? And so, you know, the idea that the public has some expectation, because, you know, we want this land to exist in the future, right? I mean, if part of the whole idea of sustainable agriculture is that, well, yeah, who's going to stand up and say, well, I'm for an unsustainable system, right? I want to wash away the soil and pollute the water. Well, nobody would necessarily stand up and say, I want to do that. But we have a fair amount of evidence that it can be happening. And so instead, I think, you know, part of it is how we both recognize, right, the private ownership and the economic incentives they have, but the significant public investment that's being made, right? And sure, if I'm a farmer and, right, what you want me to do, I'm conserving the soil and protecting the water in part because of the public interest. Well, it's natural that I say, okay, we'll provide some cost sharing, provide some incentive payments. Well, we do that. But of course, these things are, you know, part of our issue is how everything's entirely voluntary, right? I mean, do you think that all of the nitrogen's coming out of the same drainage system and tile systems equally? That the soil losses are happening equally off of all these different fields? I mean, you've driven around the state after some of these heavy rains, and you can identify these fields. Well, we aren't even willing to necessarily target or identify. Right? I wrote a piece the other day for this new book I'm working on. It says, keep your distance, right? And there's certain things we like to keep our distance from, you know, skunks and poisonous snakes. We also like to keep our distance from our soil and water quality issues, right? Well, water quality is a generalized problem in the raccoon. Okay, well, if we were going to narrow it down a little bit, but you can we identify, you know, their particular subwatersheds or Huck 12s or particular drainage systems where it's worse? Because you know there are. We don't want to get any closer. And one of the reasons we don't want to get any closer is because we don't. If we got closer, then we might say, well, my gosh, that's Paul's farm it's coming off of. And if we identified as being Paul's farm, well, then Paul might say, well, you want me to do something, right? And we don't ever want to get into that idea of blame or responsibility and say, well, Paul needs more education. Okay, Paul says, well, I'm well educated. I don't need any more education. I'm going to continue to do what I'm doing. And, okay, if that's the approach we're going to take, well, then we can expect that Paul's farm is going to be one that continues to shed a lot of water, shed a lot of soil, shed a lot of nitrogen. And until we're willing to kind of get closer, right, and think about the idea of responsibility and trying to connect, right? I mean, most of our public programs right now are designed to keep our foot on the accelerator of all-out crop production. We only tap the brakes periodically, and we don't even tap them very much, right? Okay, well, maybe the CRP, there's a tap.
Yeah, but we took a bunch of CRP out of
exactly.
The program this year.
Yeah, because what, these extra crops people are going to plant in August is going to help with the world food situation? I mean, marginally, maybe. Right. So anyway, I'm lecturing a little bit too much.
And you bring up it's kind of a, you have a whole chapter about soil, and you talk about, I think it was the page of a book, like each year, or there's a little bit that comes out. You don't notice it that sheet soil erosion. Has changed. What did you call it?
Sheet erosion.
That's it. Sheet erosion. Yeah. So all these things happen. If we don't really know, we probably always think it's the other farm. It's not ours. Yeah, we do it right.
Well, but here's, you know, and you're going to ask the question, I hope, here before we get done. Where do you find hope, right? What makes you optimistic? And I think part of the hope is there are things that we could do that make sense, and it makes sense from a farmer's profitability standpoint. I mean, I'm sure you've had people on and people talk about, oh my gosh, studies show that maybe 10% of the acres that people are farming, they're never making a profit from, right? I mean, they're the wet bottoms or the eroded hillsides, they're the turn rows, right? Well, okay, if we aren't making a profit of them, why are we still pouring nitrogen and seed and all the inputs into them? It would be better off, right, not farming them. Okay, well, how about the continuous CRP there, right? How about that being the land we put into the pollinator habitat? So you both have a conservation benefit, you have reduced input use, you have higher profitability on the part of the farmer, right? Mm-hmm. And nobody's really lost anything because they aren't making any money on these, you know, we're farming every acre like it's grade A soil.
But it's not.
It's not, right? No. And a lot of those hillsides, we've already lost most of the A horizon off of them, right? It's already been elevated downhill over time as we've lifted it, and it's moved, right? And gravity's helped pull it down, and the rains have helped. So there are things that we could do if we were a little smarter. And what we need is more incentives and inducements for people to be smarter.
Well, here's where I see optimism, Neil. And before I ask you, I look at the farmers that are younger than I am. They still have hair and it's not gray. And they are all in on a cover crop. They are all in on knowing exactly about their soil, what gets lost and what doesn't. There are some who, but I think of one gentleman in particular, fifth or seventh generation farmer. I think it's fifth. He sees a business opportunity in it, in helping educate other people on their soil. That's
You're
great.
You're talking about Mitchell Hora.
Exactly, right? I am talking about Mitchell Hora.
I'm talking about a kid like Chris Gasser, who I sold our farm to, raised son. There's a young generation of farmers out there who aren't necessarily tied to, well, we got to keep doing it that way, or there aren't ways that we can't do this better. And we need to help.
We need to help the Mitchells and the Chrises. Is that how you see the optimism? That's how I see it.
That's certainly, you know, because we're going to continue to farm this land, right? I mean, as I say, the land remains. It's resilient. We're all going to die at some point. This land, most of it's not going to die. It's going to be handed on. And in Iowa, we're going to continue to raise corn and soybeans. You know, we may get over our delusion about more ethanol all the time is somehow better for us, but, you know, that's another podcast.
It's a whole other show, yes.
That's a whole other show. But, you know, there are certainly ways that we can be more thoughtful. And one of the things I say in the book is that people need to listen to the land. And I think if you listen to the land, and I think people who farm can appreciate what that means, right? And it's not just about economics. If everything was about economics, we wouldn't have kids, right? I mean, there
are... Yeah, but the government helps us on those.
Well, there are lots
tax
of
breaks.
Lots of reasons, you know, why you want to own land. And economics is part of it, but only part of it. And...
And I'm sorry, we're gonna run up against kind of my clock that I try to do here. But you talk about the land and land trusts, and we've discussed that in the past. Do we need more? I'm sorry. Do we need less absentee landowners? Would that help this?
Well, you know, if the question was, would we be better off if more of the land was farmed by people who own it? I think the answer is probably yes, right? I mean, you can say that the footsteps of the owner are the best fertilizer. On the other hand, if the question is, so does that mean you're somehow going to prohibit absentee ownership or non-operator ownership, somehow, you know, require them to sell it? That's a whole different, right, political issue, because, you know, property rights and the ability to own property is such an ingrained part of our legal system and heritage, right? It's why a lot of people came to this country. We haven't put caps on individual ownership, and it's not clear constitutionally how we could. Corporations are different because we can treat them with a different legal standard. Non-resident aliens are different, right, in terms of foreign ownership. We could do different things. You could have progressive property taxes, right? Arguably, the more land you owned. But none of those ideas are particularly appealing. You could create ways, tax incentives being a good example, of why non-owner operators would want to sell property to an owner operator or to a beginning farmer. You could have rights of first refusal. You could, you know, now you wait around till you die to avoid the capital gains tax and get the step up in basis. So you could change that, for example, and do it maybe more intentionally than it's been proposed. But
Well, Neil Hamilton, I appreciate the time. Your last thought here on the book, right there, the land remains. We didn't even get into the whole back 40 portion of the book, and I guess you have to pick it up to understand what that's all about.
Sure. Well, the book's in part narrated by the back 40, a field on the farm I grew up on, and people have seemed to have enjoyed that part of it as well, kind of giving them an opportunity to hear a perspective with a different voice and how the land may have taken a longer horizon and thinking about what's happened to it and its future.
All right. Neil Hamilton, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you very much.
The Land Remains is available. Give it a read next time you're looking for a perspective on farming and agriculture. That will do it for this installment of the MTOM podcast. Thank you so very much for watching. We'll see you next time.